Hi, I'm Freddie from Muddy Waters Capital, and I'm here today with Søren Arndal of Blue Orca Capital, and we're going to be presenting the short of it.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Carson has fully recovered from COVID and has suspect monkeypox.
You know, I'm a great supporter of the, you know, the monkeypox pandemic, and so for, as long as he's out, I'm willing to step in. And
that was a joke. This. Carson does not have monkeypox. I've tested this morning. I don't have monkeypox either. Søren?
I'm pretty sure I don't have monkeypox, but you know, it's only 3 o'clock. Yeah, I've had COVID enough times by this point.
So I know nothing about monkeypox. And I guess the one thing I find interesting, despite knowing nothing about it, is everyone is pretty relaxed at the moment about monkeypox. And I actually remember people being pretty relaxed about COVID.
Yeah, well, monkeypox is funnier earlier in the monkeypox pandemic than COVID.
Okay.
COVID arguably was never really funny.
No.
Monkeypox suffers from the fact that it's just like arguably hilarious right from the beginning, which is probably not great for preventing monkeypox, but.
Right, it is sexually transmitted, I think.
Yeah, that's what they say. In like a really aggressive way. Like apparently you have to have like open sores in order to sexually transmit it. That's why I think like monkeypox is probably worse for mental health than COVID, because like if you get monkeypox, there's a real chance your self-esteem goes like materially down.
So anyway, Carson, if you do get monkeypox, don't let your self-esteem go down. So you know, usually we'll kind of talk on this about like recent reports from short sellers, and sometimes Carson and I have talked about reports from short sellers we think are inadequate, and sometimes we talk about stuff we think's really good. And I think this is actually standalone an interesting topic. Mm. Should short sellers criticize other short sellers?
You know, that's an interesting topic. I mean, we always get asked, right? Like, you're a short seller, you're an activist. Do you read the other activist short selling that's published in the market? Of course you do. It's like your job and your business to sort of understand what's going on in the market, understand how other, you know, no matter who it is, basically is, you know, what type of thesis, what type of evidence, what's the reaction to it. And just like any other sort of profession, there are some that you read that you're like, this was great, this is really impressive work. And then others that you're like, this is kind of laughable, this is garbage. The question is, do you like, you know, even though you're in a very good position to basically weigh the strength of other people's work on the short side, there's, I think, a general hesitancy in the community to kind of criticize. And I don't know if that's justified or not. I think like, I can see both sides. What do you think about it?
That's a really good question. I think there's a difference between like these really ad hominem personal attacks and actual criticism of the work. There are people I like who I think either have theses that are just like not particularly profound or well trafficked, and so they kind of fit into that, yeah, you're probably correct, but like, you know, I've seen you do better work kind of stuff. And then, yeah, I genuinely think there are people whose work is just uninteresting and it's kind of sloppy, and I kind of wonder how they reach those conclusions sometimes. I guess the, you know, the issue with the criticism piece is it's a really small industry. Like most activist short sellers know other activist short sellers or have worked for other activist short sellers. So, you know, we get enough criticism from the outside world in general that like the kind of, you know, friendly fire is probably not something we massively welcome.
I mean, look, I think when you're analyzing an issue which like touches on short sellers, one of the mental models that I always use is basically how do long investors behave in like a similar context? Mm-hmm. And, you know, do long investors do long hedge funds like criticize the sort of public activist short stances of other long hedge funds? Like occasionally, but I don't think it's like a, you know, in general, if they can disagree, they usually kind of disagree. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a free market, and that's the whole point, right? You're allowed to take the other side of the bet if you really think it's wrong.
Actually, speaking of that, I mean, and kind of coming back to your point, I do like if I find like a really good research technique to copy that. Like, there are occasionally short pieces I've seen from other short sellers, and I'm like, wow, you know, I looked at that company and I had an inkling. I mean, one that kind of recently came to mind was like Nate had a piece on the birth testing thing, Natera. And it was like something we kind of looked at. We knew there was this like funky little 501c3 piece. Mm. And like, you know, there were kind of like rumors from some formers that like maybe there was something untoward. And he'd actually gone a step further than I've been able to prove. And he kind of actually connected the dots in terms of how much of revenue it was responsible for. And I think there was like an undisclosed related party angle. And so like sometimes you see that and you're like, wow, I kind of really missed something.
Does that piss you off? Do you ever get like...
It's a really good question.
That's a tough one. It's a tough one when you've looked at something and then someone who you respect in the space, like you're happy for them that they did good work. And, you know, I think Nate does great work in general. And I'm, you know, but there's also an element of it when you see it, you're like, you know, you're kind of pissed at yourself and your own process.
I'm pissed at myself. I'm thinking like, hey, I could have gone further. I could have thought about that harder. Where I'm pissed off at the other short activist as if we're working on something and we're taking our time and we're like really going through the motions to make sure there are very few to no unknown unknowns. Mm. And someone puts something out that's like sloppy, it's kind of 65% of what I'm doing, and I'm just like, fuck, you've like ruined the kind of crescendo-y surprise thing. This work is like, it's not incorrect. It's just like what I then have is like incremental as opposed to brand new information. And like, yeah, I'm fucking furious. I mean, if we've been working on something for like months, I'm like just beside myself. I mean, I feel so sorry for my colleagues on those days because I'm such a short-tempered, irritable fuck. So that for me is like the biggest pain point. And yeah, I'm hypercritical of that work. I'm like, I didn't find this, and like this really sucks, and like, god, what a hack, this person should just like not be allowed to put short reports out. But really, that's just me being pissed off.
Right No, it is super frustrating, especially when you feel like someone has rushed something to market, it's poor construction, it's obviously impatient, there's, you know, they didn't do a proper job on it. That for sure sucks, but it doesn't happen as much as it used to.
Yeah. Speaking of other things that people haven't done a great job of, private investing.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't go so that far. Tiger Global apparently only marked its privates down 9% in Q1.
That's true. And I don't think D1 have marked any down.
I don't know if this is true, but one of my friends who's very familiar with the space told me that D1 was up last year because even though their public investments lost, they reported like a 25% yearly gain based on the markup of their private, or they're based on like a large markup, like 70% of their privates. I don't know if that's true, but
if it's close to being true,
if it's even, and I think the
directionally,
the rumor also tells you a lot about the truth in the market in a way. Like, I think that practice is really common, and you know, it kind of gets this big discussion that we're having in the market now, which is what everyone asks you as a short seller, which is, where's the bottom? Right? Where is, this thing is sold off 80%. Surely it's a buy. Mm-hmm. Stuff like that. Hilarious for a couple of reasons. One, we don't know shit about where the bottom is, right?
Like the last guys that you want to ask about the bottom are us. And I got to tell you, the worst thing that could ever happen is we buy the bottom. Because if I buy the absolute bottom, I'm probably selling when things are up 20%. And I'm like, or at the bottom, it's in, it's up 20, it's going down from here. So there's like no chance that I'm going to benefit from buying the bottom. It's wasted on me.
It's wasted, 100%. No, I mean, the people ask us all the time, right? They're like, where's, you know, you guys, like, there's this confusion that like short sellers are somehow macroeconomic prognosticators, when in reality,
I was marketing last week. I was telling everyone that I was a macro prognosticating genius.
Also, for future reference, if anyone I'm marketing to in the future sees this, I also understand macro. but you think about the macro environment of like where the bottom is, and you know, the absence of marking down any of these private investments, that only puts more selling pressure
Yes.
On parts of the market that we don't see, right? And when a lot of these tiger cubs or these levered long funds that are, you know, reporting 25, 30, 40, 50% down, they're going to start getting redemptions soon.
Yes.
And where they, before they were a buyer at any price, when they're a seller at any price, you know, what happens to those private investments that they can't sell? Are they side pocketed?
It's a good question. I think there are some funds who have dedicated private vehicles. There are some funds who commingle. Now that the commingled model is incredibly dangerous on the way down, because if you start marking your privates down, and it, again, it depends on the marking policies of these funds. Some people, I assume, have to do some sort of like mark to model type process. Other people are probably marking at last. Whether you are or aren't charging fees, there's different share classes. There's a lot going on to untangle there. But at a really base level, if you are not marking your privates down, your public piece is getting small and small. It is the only place you can get liquidity for redemptions.
Yeah, that's right.
And that ends up being a big problem, because you're not the only person that knows this. Your LPs are too. And so they likely don't want to be left holding the bag with a bunch of privates in a commingled vehicle if liquidity is getting sucked out of your public market bet. So,
and you're not the only fund that is undergoing the same process.
Right.
And the if when a subset or a large number of funds start doing the same thing at the same time, all of the pressures that worked when the market was going up that sent stocks into the stratosphere just work in the reverse on the way down. It's going to be, you know, and so you ask questions like, where's the bottom? You know, it's hard from a macroeconomic standpoint to make an estimate as a short seller, but you do know that there's a lot of selling pressure. And that selling pressure, I don't think, has even really begun.
There's a lot of selling pressure, and, you know, the world is super focused on hedge funds, actually. I mean, it's a really small part of real money. You know, we're all like, every week there's another like article on this, you know, prominent hedge fund or that one or a tiger cub. Like, the reality is, some even $20 billion hedge fund liquidating like 10, 15% of its book, 20, 30% of its book, it's an absolute drop in the bucket. And what happens is, over a longer time period, you have like real money flows.
Right.
So you have the big long onies. I mean, those guys are managing hundreds of billions of dollars.
Well, you also have people withdrawing money from the retirement account to get liquidity.
Right, drawing money from retirement accounts. You have fewer people in employment, so you have less of the target date flows. That is the stuff that really moves the needle in terms of real money. And then you also have allocators. So whether it's endowments or pension funds, they have target allocations. And so, and some of these you know, endowments and pension funds, they actually have like distributions that they really need to make for students or for, you know, people whose pensions that they have to pay out. So they're in a situation where, again, depending on the amount of money they have allocated to private credit, private equity, venture capital, vehicles that are locked up, capital commitments for drawdown type structures, they may also be in a situation where the only place they can really find liquidity to sell is public markets. And I don't mean hedge funds per se, I mean large portfolios of stocks they own. So to my mind, sentiment is incredibly bearish. I mean, that's the kind of unusual thing here. It's kind of consensus from everyone that markets are going lower at some point in the next few months. The level of bearishness kind of, you know, varies from person to person, but it certainly seems to be like pretty sentiment driven. The question is, for me, like, do you get this massive glut of real money selling or not? And if you don't, maybe we are like slightly nearer a bottom than a top, who really knows? But if you do get this real money flow, I mean, you could see like huge legs lower in the stuff that people love and don't want to sell, where it's an Apple or, okay, I'm struggling to think of a stock that's still up.
Berkshire.
Yeah.
Berkshire.
Berkshire. Yeah. So I think for me, that's interesting. And the other thing that we're really starting to just see is like how fucking poor some of these business models were. I mean, let's talk about Klarna.
Klarna, incredible. One of my friends actually was participating in that very last round that they did. I think it was last fall, their last raise.
Okay.
And hilariously,
what price was that at?
It was like the type of, it was the price, I think it was at their top valuations, was about $70 billion.
Okay.
And he was also paying a a 7 to 10% fee on top of the placement. So there was
like a weigh-in fee.
Yeah, there was like a weigh-in fee because someone was marketing the deal to him. It was just egregious that people were paying that. But what was remarkable is that, like, you know, Klarna, for those of you who don't know, valued about $70 billion. The comps, all the buy now, pay later comps were basically at all-time highs, something mm-hmm. like Affirm, Afterpay, which was acquired by Square. Klarna was using an aggressive mark essentially based on the public comps, mm-hmm. which, you know, you could argue whether it's fair. But if you use the public comps to mark yourself up to $70 billion and you use the public comps today, the real number is you're down 70 to 80%.
Yeah, and I mean, I think what I found actually pretty amazing is like, these guys are fucking hemorrhaging money. Like
hemorrhaging money. They announced a series of layoffs. But that doesn't really stop the bleeding because if you look at, you know, Klarna in their latest financials that were disclosed, what, $15 billion in revenue?
Yeah.
And $4 billion in credit losses off of that? If you're losing a third of your revenue to essentially credit losses and the pain hasn't really started in the broader market, mm-hmm. and then you have, and you're so EBITDA and cash flow negative, you're just...
I think it's interesting, like that whole point about like the pain. There's a lot of debate about the consumer and housing a little bit, and I hope all the bears are wrong on housing because I now own one, so I really strongly identify with the bullish trends there. But going back to the consumer, the credit card data has actually not been that bad, and I don't religiously follow it. Like some, you know, I've read a few sell side reports recently, kind of with the, you know, I think it was like the March or April data. And I think what's interesting about that is default rates haven't massively spiked. And actually, cash bank balances are still better than they were, I think, for most people than pre-pandemic. And so I wonder how much of that is masked by the Afterpay, the Klarna, whatever it is, Block or thing, Square, whatever the board. Like, how much of that is like someone being able to tap like a couple $1,000s for a short period of time off balance sheet, and then they go to their credit card provider because they know that's going to show up on a credit score. Because I don't think the buy now, pay later guys actually do like a hard credit pull, right? It's some like kind of like quasi soft credit pull thing. So you just kind of wonder, are we about to get hit with like a deluge of really bad data?
Well, the, for example, subprime like auto loans, those have started to roll over a little bit, which is pretty concerning. Yeah.
Almost as concerning as if you're Apollo, you just funded that Carvana 2030. Yeah.
Or if you're Tiger and you decided to rotate out of your more like risky growth stocks and pile into Carvana in Q1.
Yeah.
Like that. Oh, man.
Oh, man. That's going to go down with like one of the greatest ever buy the dip calls.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I mean, they're all laughing all the way to the bank.
I know. But, I mean, some of those guys might have to get a job with Ross Gerber. It's not that bad.
Yeah, it's not that bad. Jamba Juice is hiring. Oh man. Yeah, so I think they'll be fine. A couple of funny things. We definitely said don't trust us on macroeconomic predictions and then spent the next 10 minutes giving our macroeconomic predictions. That was good.
Yeah, but we have the disclaimer on the bottom.
We have the disclaimer. The disclaimer is like, hugely important.
Right. It's the equivalent to like smoking cigarettes, right? Like we all know it's bad, but if you do want to go and talk to a girl smoking cigarettes, you got to go over and smoke your own cigarette.
You know, I was just in Brazil for a friend's wedding.
Mm-hmm.
And smoking is one of those interesting global trends. You just don't see it in the United States. And you go abroad,
you
and
do
the
see
number
it.
Of people that still smoke, it's makes me want to buy Altria.
So it's interesting, actually. There was a company that Altria bought or bid for called Swedish Match. And
Swedish Match, like the Swedish Match from Ivar Kruger back in the day?
The Swedish Match from Ivar Kruger. They have a product, like a smokeless tobacco, like a little pouch thing that you put in your mouth, and it's growing like gangbusters. And John Hempton wrote this piece. I think it's his largest position. I've long followed his blog, and unfortunately he doesn't write as much anymore. I wish he would. I'm pretty sure his compliance guy was like, hey, you're running a lot more money now, like don't write mean things, but he wrote this awesome blog post about how, like, you know, actually they're paying a really cheap price for the company, and the management team are complete ass clowns, and just like landed yeah. in a, I think it was like, he gave some great quote, like, landed in a pot full of rainbows and dicks or something, and just like, you know, it was some brilliant quote. I'm butchering it. I strongly recommend you look it up. And you know, it kind of like got me thinking, like, there are all these like really interesting things that just because we're sat in a place in the world and we use the yeah. product, and I think for a lot of these tech businesses, that's what people extrapolated out, whether it was Peloton or Zoom or whatever. They're like, I'm a user of the product, like, sweet green. Like, hey, I see it on every corner.
I pay $20 for a salad. Other people are going to, too.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think it's really funny how when you, like, take these kind of things that we do as consumers and you, like, extrapolate it out and, you know, you go and look back and you're like, what were we thinking, right? Like, a Peloton yeah. is just, you know, a bike with an iPad on it.
I mean, consumer products is a harder investment. Usually harder investment to kind of get a sense of what the convergence is to intrinsic value. And the reason is the consumer products are generally more popular with retail, right?
Yeah.
You know, what were the names during the pandemic? You know, stuff like GameStop, you know, incels buying video games. Like mm-hmm. they knew that business. They going to movie theaters, AMC.
They
Bed Bath and Beyond. Like, I don't really, that one doesn't make a ton of sense. But the you know, it's consumer products are a little bit more difficult for that very reason, right? You just have mm-hmm. so much availability bias, which basically just informs the analysis, whether you like it or not. It's really hard to strip that out. But it's availability bias, as you said, just conditioned onto whatever mm-hmm. like, you're seeing in your,
right.
you know, your consumer interactions.
I think that kind of ties into the whole ESG point as well, because, you know, here we are, like, traditionally tobacco has been shunned as an ESG play, and a lot of people are under pressure to allocate to things that are, you know, more ESG friendly. So we just saw today, Glencore settled, I think, with the Department of Justice and a bunch of other agencies for about £1.5 billion or dollars. And the stock went up. And a lot of people have shunned Glencore. There is, you know, an activist trying to get them to spin off their coal business. And that is making an ungodly amount of money at the moment. I think Dan Loeb might have written in his letter that you know, they own some Glencore because of that. And there's this real kind of signaling thing, which is leading to certain funds really overstepping in terms of selling their ESG credentials and other asset classes being massively shunned.
Yeah.
As a short seller, do you look for stuff that's kind of wearing the ESG halo? Do
Absolutely.
You not care? Do you?
ESG has become the biggest area of research mm-hmm. for us. And I think probably for many short sellers, it is at a very high level, the fundamental problem is that in theory, ESG, especially the environmental investment, might be a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
However, there are so many dollars that are being allocated to it by mandate. So passive flows, the BlackRocks, the world, mm-hmm. which get very politically controversial these days in the US. But there's so high of a mandate to invest in ESG, and there's so few companies that are actually worthy of investment
mm-hmm.
that there's too many dollars chasing too few good ideas, and that, of course, attracts all the charlatans
yep.
and attracts all the stock promoters. And, you know, well, you look at any given space and you say, well, there's 2 to 3 reasonable ESG investments there. However, you know, there's billions upon billions of capital that needed basically to be dumped into the sector.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to dump it into 10 to 15 companies that are just utter pieces of shit.
Mm-hmm.
And the, you know, as a short seller, what you're always trying to do is you are following where the froth is, right?
Yep.
You're following what is the hottest space, because you know that the hottest space today usually is going to attract the most disreputable characters tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you kind of focus your time and research. So ESG now is in this space where, you know, so many of the good companies are just trading at crazy valuations. Mm-hmm. They're insanely overcapitalized. And the money has just flowed to this like subset of ESG investments, which are just, you know, you combine that with SPAC's ability to like make whatever projections they sort of felt like.
No, you think yeah. they did that?
Yeah, I mean, they might do that. We'll find out.
Find out, yeah.
Yeah, and so for sure. I mean, with you guys too, right? I think you're looking at ESG.
Yeah, we spent a decent amount of time on it. Mm-hmm. I mean, we shorted XL Fleet Corp. I'm gonna say that was February, March of last year. It's actually amazing. That is now actually trading significantly below its cash value. So
that makes sense because they probably burn so much every quarter.
This is the funny thing. It's actually not burning that much money. So what is truly unique about that is, so here's a company that we're projecting they were gonna do about 280 odd million in sales this year. They've only done 4.5 or maybe 4.8 this quarter, but you know, it's going to be a story of year of two halves, right?
Yeah, so. And three quarters of that was to a related party, but the,
whatever. Small details.
Yeah, the CEO's mom bought just like four trucks.
And so what's kind of really interesting is that is we actually looked and thought, hey, is there something to do here? I mean, they're not burning that much cash. They don't seem to have a ton of liabilities. Could you just scrap the whole thing? And there were these rights, I think they're called Revlon rights.
Revlon duties.
Yeah. And what is...
Flashback, hashtag corporate lawyer.
God, did you go to Harvard as well? Just so you can get in all your favorite topics.
Did you know that?
So what's really interesting is based on Revlon duties and some kind of preliminary work we've done, the directors of these companies stand less chance of getting sued if they take the enormous pile of money, which dwarfs the market cap, and literally light it on fire, than they do getting sued from existing shareholders if they just div out all the cash. It is the most mind-blowing conflict of interest. Now, again, with XL Fleet Corp, there potentially could be some liabilities because I think there are numerous shareholder suits related to some of the work we did. So there would be this kind of like strange irony, but I just find it bizarre that the people who are crap stewards of capital have this incentive to burn more capital as opposed to returning it to investors.
But, you know, I bet if you looked at the shareholding of a lot of those board members, they have very little financial interest to dividend it out.
Right.
Because I mean,
before they just had very little interest, full stop.
Right. Well, before they were interested in A, continuing director's fees,
yes,
and B, playing golf and not having that disrupted.
Yes.
But, you know, this is a point that, you know, say what you want about Elon. Elon, I think, correctly made with respect to Twitter.
Yep.
Was that none of the board actually really use it. None of them own any stock.
Yep.
How are they aligned with the incentive of shareholders? And how do they understand the best future for this product? Now, Nate did some great work, I thought, on the Twitter thing. I thought it was a great piece that he published. And, you know, do you think he gets it done? I don't know. I think he gets it done at a lower price.
It's super interesting.
I mean, Snap's down like 50%. You got to look at that comp and say, I'm paying less for this.
You know, I think what's really interesting is Twitter probably has been like under-monetized, whatever that means. Snap is just a shit platform. I bet Miranda Kerr is wishing she stayed with Joe Lowe now, given he's actually got some cash. Don't worry, Evan, I'm joking. He's still my boy. I think what's really interesting is the doc is pretty tight, okay? So if you look at the Twitter deal, there's not wiggle room. Now, he might be trying with the bots thing, which he, P.S., has like repeatedly been bitching about prior to that. I don't think a judge is going to take kindly. Delaware judges are a real thing. This is not some Mickey Mouse pretend like you can bully. This is a very serious...
The Chancery Court takes the works very seriously.
Right. I think the trade here is for like Elliot to step in, and I think the spread's probably in like the 30s now, and say, you know what, we're going to buy 10% of this. I think they either currently own stock or previously, sue for performance. And be like, you know what, Elon, you are a big swinging dick, but I'm like Paul Singer.
Paul Swinger.
Dude, get that in there.
Yeah.
Paul Swinger. I like
different
that.
Different guy. Yeah.
But, you know, I'm Paul Singer, and like, I'm a pretty sharp guy, and I probably know more about this than you do. It seems like maybe you got a little bit carried away and overpaid, and I think I can force you to perform. And I think that's super interesting, because I'll tell that's you what, if Elon gets away with repricing this deal, every merger arb spread on the planet should probably widen, because every single CEO is just gonna be like, you know what? If you act a little bit crazy and you just kind of like push it a little bit, you can probably get every board on the planet to reprice a deal. And if you look at COVID, I don't think there were many deals that were repriced lower, if I remember correct.
I think at the beginning of COVID, there were a bunch of deals that were repriced lower, but then everything went absolutely bananas. And so valuations went up, and so there was no point to reprice the deals anyway. So I think this is a area of law that we would have seen sort of the specific performance of merger arb play out a little bit more during COVID, but we really never got the chance because valuations rebounded so quickly. It'll be really interesting to see what happens. Do they get specific performance? I think he's correct in that the platform's under-monetized, but, does he just pay the billion and just...
But that's not how it works.
It's not how it
break
works, though.
Break fees are not like,
the
oh, I've changed
are
my
not,
mind.
I changed my mind. It's not for walk for any reason. It's...
Right.
Yeah.
And, Tesla's stock has been sliding. Like, all of a sudden...
Stock's been sliding. I mean, look at the comp set, as we said earlier. Like,
XL Fleet Corp.
XL Fleet Corp.
What was the one you did, the shit show SPAC you published on?
Eisen.
Yeah. What is that, like down 90?
Yeah, I think it's down pretty significantly.
Yeah.
It's like, I think, in the $3, $4 range.
Gotcha. It'll be there soon.
It'll be really interesting. I mean, it'll be really, like, we're going to start to see, I think one of the larger kind of predictions we have is how... when the market starts to shake out at these really high levels, a guy like Elon has he's not specifically, I don't think, overly levered, really. Like, he's got obviously a ton of his net worth tied up in stocks, but he's also got some really decent exposure to like energy and SpaceX, which probably, it's probably a good, government contracts aren't going away.
And, true.
And so he's somewhat hedged, I think, in that sense, but man, the rotation out of some of these, these high-flying assets, like, stablecoins, crypto.
Oh, dude, Terra.
Like, if they don't put that, if that guy doesn't go down, then...
The Korean guy.
Do Kwon. I mean, it appears that given the collapse of it, there's also this great article in the Wall Street Journal today about whether they actually used the foundation, which was supposed to provide essentially
to prop
relief
up.
To actually. So they said that they transferred it to a wallet in order to trade to prop it up.
Guess what?
And guess what? There's some question about whether they actually did that. If that turns out to be true, I don't know how.
Wow, that's...
This starts to become one of the biggest frauds of all time, if that's the case.
Yeah, it's funny. Mike Novogratz obviously got that Luna tattoo, and... I don't have any tats, but I'm probably thinking if I was to get one, a Luna tattoo would be
dude,
my...
No, you got to get a tattoo of Mike Novogratz with the Luna tattoo.
So funny
that's
you say that.
Meta.
My colleague, Alex, typically the person with the Ivy League education at Muddy Waters, is in the lowest rung on the totem pole. My colleague, Alex...
Yeah, you're intellectually insecure, obviously. So.
My father did say that I should apply to Oxford on the basis that someone had to be bottom and I would have no problem anchoring that. But, it's funny. He was at Princeton, so he's going... They have, this big reunion, and I guaranteed him a higher bonus if he could get a picture, with the Novogratz Luna tattoo and... some thumbs up.
I think if you tweet that to Novogratz, he actually might do it.
Well, because he needs the cash now for tattoo removal.
I think he's all right.
So yeah,
that's the biggest ex-girlfriend tat. It's so brutal.
It really does suck. But look, the crypto thing is interesting. If I were gonna get a tattoo, my friend actually a couple hours ago sent me. There's a coin that you mine more by walking. It's somehow attached, the pedometer on your phone. We'll get it up on screen for those who are interested. I would probably get that one. Walking one, yeah. Just so I could feel better about having only done 2,000 steps a day. I could be I made 8 crypto whatever tons they are. So that's, I wouldn't see it as a negative that I'd missed my 10,000 steps a day. I'd be I made $8 in whatever these are.
Oh, so it's you get coin based on the number of steps or the inverse?
No, the number of steps.
We should do the inverse.
The couch?
Just the fat,
couch coin.
Yeah, the fat coin where you're just cool, I get paid on the inverse of the amount of calories that I burn in a day. You basically index it to your BMI. Yeah.
Okay.
Just what's the burn that you should do as a reasonable person and whatever you get.
So look, if, Sequoia
I don't
or
think anyone can criticize that in this day and age. That would be shaming.
That would be shame.
Yeah, that's not appropriate.
Okay, and you know what? I don't know if the Midwest has enough crypto, so let's get it going. Cool. Well, on that bombshell, I think we should end before we get canceled. But hey, if we get canceled and Carlson doesn't have monkeypox, he'll be back presenting anyway.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Pleasure. Thank you for coming in. All right, man.